Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
Sean O'Sullivan, I'm head of policy at the Royal College of Midwives. And thank you very much for coming. We're hoping for a few more people, but we will have a more intimate and valuable discussion maybe. As I say, this session is on commissioning, and in the previous session that was touched on particularly by Claire Gerada. But for those of you who don't know, from the 1st of April next year, when strategic health authorities and PCTs are abolished, responsibility for commissioning maternity services will transfer to clinical commissioning groups. So this obviously raises a lot of uncertainty and questions. What value will clinical commissioning groups bring that perhaps PCTs didn't? What difference will women and families notice in the way that services are delivered, and what difference this will midwives notice? And how does clinical commissioning groups fit in with the other new bodies that are emerging, such as maternity and children's strategic clinical networks and health and wellbeing boards? So to answer these and many other questions, we've got two guest speakers with us today. On my right is Dr. James Kingsland, OBE. You are chair of the National Clinical Commissioning Network, and you have previously been chairman and president of the National Association of Primary Care. You've advised the government on commissioning.
Not my fault.
But you've also received an OBE in the Queen's Honours List for services to general practice. And on my left, Dr. Suzanne Tyler, who is currently Associate Director of Maternity Programmes for NHS South of England. I'm delighted to say, as of January, she'll be coming to work for the Royal College of Midwives as our new Director of Services to Members. We've got to finish at four, so we'll crack on now. And I think, James, you're going to start.
Sean, thank you. And yes, just to qualify, it says a management masterclass. This is about clinical commissioning, so I want to keep it focused on clinical services, because I'm a GP. I've been a GP for 23 years. I'm only half-time now because the other half-time is contracted to the Department of Health to develop a programme to get more and more clinicians involved in this reform at the level where it really matters, where patients identify quality at the interface where they meet their clinician. But to the other, I say 23 years as a GP in... anyone from Liverpool here or what? I'm from Wallasey. That's the... All right, I'm on the Riviera side of the Mersey. Yes, we're just hearing... maybe just touch on the one-to-one in Wirral as well about the issues, because that's in our area, which is getting mixed reports, better reports from ladies receiving it, actually, from some of the colleagues who are commissioning it. But what I want to do is try and have a dialogue as well, because what part of my remit at the moment, leading this clinical commissioning programme, and certainly my GP colleagues would have got it if we were talking about the reform of primary care provision, they all get it, as opposed to becoming a clinical commissioner, which is something that is often misunderstood. God forbid we get GPs or clinicians into activities where they're procuring new services or using procurement tools to look where there's gaps in service, and then contract management. It was never about that. It was about where clinicians do needs assessment, I call it a consultation, and then secure the best service against that need. That might be a referral, it might be a prescription, it might be advice. But that is the bit where we need the full clinical community acting in a way that changes slight behaviours, in as much that those decisions commit resources. And those resources we've never had control of, now we have, because the law has made us accountable. And us is anyone in the NHS who themselves are a clinical resource, who commits resource, are in clinical commissioning, whether we're conscious of it or not. It was first called GP commissioning because it was more about the referrer, and in the main the referrer is the general practitioner. We're seeing more and more community nursing making direct referrals into secondary care. But there's also the other resources that are used by district nurses, health visitors, community midwifery. So we've got to make sure that everybody is involved. If this becomes just a programme for one clinical specialty, and that's why it was changed from GP commissioning to clinical commissioning, and the debate that I want to get really involved in is how best to secure services against patients' needs, where clinicians need to make the decisions. Once we've made the decisions, who puts the contract in place and how that's monitored is for expert management. We don't want to get involved in that, but we want to determine the service, the care pathways, the reform of care, not to the restructuring of the NHS, which I'm a little bit concerned that we're still doing the, rather than form following function, completely consumed in restructuring our NHS rather than looking at the reform of care. What I want to do is be quiet for a while, because part of my programme as well is to create what's called a soft intelligence report for the commissioning board. It goes into everyone from David Nicholson's office to all other clinical directors, into NICE, into CQC, into Monitor as well, which is sort of getting the mood music of the service as much as some of the detailed reporting that comes through organisations, membership organisations, is to say what is really happening out there, what is really challenging the service in clinical commissioning, what is being misunderstood, because we still talk about commissioning as a process that is done by management and we're moving clinicians to management. This is about how do we reform care pathways. So if we're looking at maternity services, if we don't have a room filled with those who are involved in the care of families who are going through pregnancy, and that might be the general practitioner, the midwife, the health visitor, it might be the community nursing, the practice nursing, anyone who's involved, if we start to reform care without all of those in the room at the start, we'll fail spectacularly. If we think commissioning is about just somebody, the payer, having the money to buy the service differently and expect providers to jump to their tune, we have failed in not only the narrative, but in the reform of what is being delivered. I've just got another couple of things that you've all have heard about the NHS mandate. Has anyone seen it? It's been published today, this afternoon. I've picked out two lines in the mandate, which is interesting. The mandate to liberate clinicians, not direct them in their day-to-day activity. And there's some interesting lines about maternity care, which I'll mention. But what I want to do is take a break and just get some feedback, but based on, I'll just read you what the mandate is saying, because I would like to take some debate back into a report, which I can get into the commissioning board next week, about what it really means to reform, particularly from my point of view, community maternity services, and what it should look like. Because the mandate, I always get a bit irritated. Better care for women during pregnancy. My worry about these reforms is, who said we were doing a bad job? We can always improve care, yes, but let's recognise the NHS does a really good job. And what we need to do is always analyse, always see if we can improve it, but not start to say we're doing a poor job. And I think the politicians sometimes don't get that. Including, this is where the mandate is saying, where it says it's not to tell them, i.e. clinicians, what to do, but including named midwife responsible for ensuring personalised, wait for this, one-to-one, wonder where they got that from, throughout pregnancy, childbirth and the postnatal period. And by 2015, everybody should be able to find out how well this is happening. Now, I'll throw my hat in the ring now and say that when I first went into practice, and one of the most important parts of integrated care that I experienced, it was a long time ago, I went into practice in 89, and at a lunchtime meeting where I was sitting with Helen, our community midwife, Mo, the health visitor. Do health visitors still exist? I've not seen one for a few years. Do they? Oh, right. I think they're a myth, because I've not seen one for about 4 years. I thought maybe they think I've been extinct as well as a GP. But Mo, the health visitor, and Jane, the clinical psychologist who was doing sessions, were sitting, talking about Sarah, who 3 days postnatally, after her third child, was showing signs of clinical depression that she'd had in the past. And with the GP and the clinical team, we were talking over lunch with our sandwich about the best care for this lady. And at the end of that, a clinical psychologist, a health visitor and a midwife got in a car together and did a home visit. Didn't need the GP. We'll say, well, we'll get you in if we need you to prescribe or something. At that time, they were. But that process of integrated care, Claire Gerard was saying about, we're worried about transactions. No transactions, no letters going between the team. One care record, because they were all importing at that very rudimentary time of the IT system, the care record, going off to determine, then coming back about the best care pathway. We had some budget at that time, I'll use the F word. We're not going back to fund holding, but it was some control where the general practice as a primary care home, not just where the GP sat, was determining how best to use certain services. Maternity services weren't in there, but we were able to buy clinical psychology services in. We were able to shape some of the health visiting services. And the best service, as Claire Gerarda was saying, was shaped around whether it's right or wrong, but if we're going to continue with list-based practice, where patients first access the NHS in the majority of contacts, is that the right team is there. Now, in midwifery services, that team was able to cope, and you know, whether we're going to get the 3,000 or 5,000 midwives with this, I think we're third now, is it? You all know better than me. Third out of 27 European countries in the current birth rate. So the pressure's on the service, and then the pressure to have the same named midwife from the almost the moment of conception to the 10 days postnatally doesn't seem to be practical. But what the patients in my practice and over time have always said, we want continuity of care within our community. When I go into have, I want a safe birth. I can't remember who, you know, it was pretty painful. You know, I just wanted to have a quick, safe birth and get back home and have the continuity of my community team, people I got to know, trust. And that team was those who were involved in my care, which included the GP, good old Ballantyne, and the system that I first went into practice, saying there was a shared care program, which I've been a bit de-skilled now. I think I've got my sonic aid somewhere, but it's getting a bit rusty because I'm not allowed to see ladies in the antenatal or postnatal period. So what I think clinical commissioning, I'll take a break at this point, cause is that we need to discuss what is the best process in antenatal, yes, intrapartum, but postnatal, particularly antenatal and postnatal in the community, and design what it should be like, and then we put the money to it, to that service. Don't ask some organisation, because we should be devolving some budgetary control to the people who commit that resource. And in maternity services, that is the community midwives with their general practice and others who necessarily need to be involved. That's what clinical commissioning was always meant. If you've heard otherwise, we've got a problem. We've got a poor narrative. Our Secretary of State lost his job because he couldn't quite tell the story properly. But it is the programme where CCGs, as membership organisations, devolving resource, the control of the budget, right down to putting patients as the centre of control and the clinicians who determine the best pathway with their patients, and then the resources are deployed around that. We then get some people to put a contract together and manage that, and some people at CCGs could... Is this making some sense? And this is what you've heard, or is it completely alien? Because that's what clinical commissioning was all about. I'll take a break, Sean, because I want to just get some feedback immediately about whether I'm talking some sense or not, or what you think would be appropriate for community midwifery services, because I would like to put that in a report tomorrow and get it to the commissioning board to say, I've actually had a chance to speak to 20, 30 colleagues, and this is the immediate response to the mandate.
Okay, Sean. Thank you, yeah. James. Speaker there, and then some in the front row.
That's what I've been keeping
this piece of paper. I'm Sharon Hodgkiss. I'm regional screening lead for the West Midlands, but I was a community team leader for 10 years when the thing called change in childbirth was around. Ended the first marriage, but women were happy. But taking it back to what you said, I was around in the PCGs when we did have the fund holding, and that co-working with your GP as a health visitor, as a midwife, as a team, as you said, we seem to have broke something that was already good. And we're really looking at it again now, and if they bothered to ask the midwives out there that do the job on a daily basis and don't want to do one or two visits postnatally, because you quite know that woman gets a bit depressed at day three, and you can't do a bath demo even though they want you to. So there's so much restriction. So I think if GPs have got the parent, you know the families, you're there throughout the whole life of many families, is to give midwives that power back to be able to say, I need to go in and give breastfeed support, and I get quite passionate about it. But midwives aren't allowed to practice as midwives anymore because you're only allowed to do so many visits. And I used to sneak in and do another visit when I was off duty. So if you're getting that power back, then the thing I would say is, you know, work with the midwives to do that.
Okay, Caroline, Carmel, Elizabeth, and then the lady in the next row.
22 years. Oh, thank you. I'm Caroline Flint, independent midwife. For 22 years, I ran a birth centre, a private birth centre. It was meant to be an NHS birth centre, but the NHS rescinded on the deal the day before it opened, which pushed me into financial penury, as you can imagine. And thankfully, I married quite a wealthy man, so he kept it going. He's not a wealthy man anymore. But For years, I tried to contract into the NHS. I tried to contract in to look after teenage mothers. I tried to contract in to get people to come to our birth centre. I did actually sell 10 home births to Redhill and Reigate NHS Trust. And I cannot tell you the frustration. Now, I have to say, you're not filling me with hope. I mean, I did employ 18 midwives, and our results were absolutely staggeringly good. I mean, absolutely staggeringly good. They were just brilliant. I don't get the feeling when I'm hearing you that if I came tomorrow to you, it seems that the ideas are already made up. It doesn't, you know. I think you need to be a bit more open. Excuse my saying, and say, okay, midwives, what can you give me? Which is easy said, I suppose, but maybe we're not as good as writing contracts and all the rest of it. I just don't know, but sorry, that's my contract.
No, I was saying about Andrew Lansley losing his job over poor narrative, maybe I should lose mine as well, because I wouldn't disagree with a lot you've said. What we're talking about with the service is securing the best service. Now, that service, hopefully, if the current NHS family is delivering good access, responsive care, high quality, why would we need to go elsewhere? But where there's gaps in service, so we need to expand service, and we know that with the increasing birth rate and the shortage of midwives, there may be gaps in service. One-to-one in Wirral was about bringing in a new service, and the procurement of that new service, let's get our NHS manager saying, where we've got a gap in provision, or under provision, or we need new provision, let's go out and use a procurement tool. The procurement tool that's to try and keep bureaucracy to a minimal is the any qualified provider. It's just a procurement vehicle. It's not an end in itself. It's saying that if somebody can meet the standards of the NHS, can get an NHS contract, and it's determined by the commission who say we've got a gap in midwifery services, if that contract, and we're always a little bit grey in this, if that contract is then given, it does not guarantee any volume of work or cost in the contract, only that you will be paid at the tariff as all other NHS services will be paid. So if patients come then through choice, and it's not a choice in, because there's this misunderstanding about choice. Well, choice is never meant to be a health supermarket. Choice was about giving patients more information to make better decisions about their care, even improve self-care. So that if there's a new service, that new service has its own set of costs, its own risk. Yes, it's got an NHS contract, but if no patients go there, there's no income to that service. But that should be for all NHS services. The contracts that are changing to cost per case and paying only when you get the right outcome. We could call it payment by results, but that's what it was meant to be, i.e. that all was on a level playing field, not the old ISTC programmes, the independent sector trick, where you locked money to try and create some tension in the NHS family to change care. This was about giving access to new providers who would then be badged NHS, have an NHS contract, but not guaranteed any volume of work. But somebody doesn't agree with me.
I'll take two more questions now, but we have to finish at four, and we've not heard from Suzanne yet. So if you go ahead, could you hold on to your question, and we'll come back to you. So Carmel and Elizabeth, and then we'll move on to Suzanne. Oh, sorry, front row.
Carmel Lloyd, Standards Development, NMC. I'm just interested in terms of going back to this situation where you've got a piece, you know, you've got a cake and you've got to slice it into, you know, any number of pieces. And traditionally, of course, midwives and maternity services always seem to get the last sliver of the cake. And I'm just wondering, how can one be assured that actually with all these competitors coming into the market, and that's including the NHS, is how are you going to ensure that actually, because you're not obviously going to ring-fence any of this, is how are you going to make sure that actually, if you like, maternity services and the role that midwives do is actually factored into that?
Just quickly, ring-fencing, well, possibly. If you've got existing services that are working, it is not anti-competitive to continue a dialogue with existing services and continue those contracts. That is not challengeable. It's only where the commissioners are saying there are gaps in service. So if you've got an adequate service or a good service, hopefully a good service, covering all the need of the local population, Why would you go elsewhere? This was never meant to say, let's shake the market up, we've got a great service, but we're going to bring new providers in to compete for the sake of competition. That was never what the... and certainly what AQP was never designed for. AQP was designed, and I was one of the ones who named it about 7 years ago, and it was AWP, was designed to bridge gaps where there's underprovision, where it was difficult to get service for patients because it was a difficult to doctor area or difficult to get services, that we needed a new tool that created less bureaucracy for access for new entrants. But if you're saying, why would you want to get competition when you've got existing good service? The answer is, I've no idea. That doesn't seem to fit with what the initial policy about choice and competition was ever about, designed by John Reid, but that's forgotten. There was a document a long time ago in the NHS called an organisation with a memory. Remember that? We've got an organisation with amnesia, haven't we?
Yeah.
Sorry, John.
Elizabeth.
Hello, I'm Elizabeth Duff, Senior Policy Advisor at NCT. Now, formerly spent many years working on a maternity services liaison committee in a city borough of London. I wanted to add something to what you were describing as your narrative, and hopefully back right at the beginning of it in the once upon a time bit, there were a lot of women who wanted care while they were having their babies. And where are the women's and their families' voices going to be in the commissioning process? And I mentioned MSLCs, Maternity Service Liaison Committees, because I believe, certainly for much of their lifetime so far, they were actually a very good model of a multidisciplinary professional forum where women's voices were heard as well, not as a user group, but as a proper strategic advisory committee. I don't know if those are going to continue after 1st of April next year, but I do believe that that model or a similar one should be there, because it is an excellent and well-established way of hearing what women have to say. And I don't think that women are going to say a lot of things that you don't want to hear or shout for things that they can't have because it costs too much. Usually, if there is good communication between all the professional groups and managers, you hear that services can be built around what women want. It doesn't cost more. It keeps women happier. It actually promotes normal birth where that can happen. And services out in the community where women can access them. And less cost happening in high-tech, high-cost environments. So I look forward to hearing how that's going to happen.
Well, the old no decision about me without me was to put the idea of the inherent control in our NHS was with the patients. CCGs, part of their authorisation, probably the number one is, how are you involving the population you serve who are largely registered with your constituent general practices in the design of service? They won't get authorised if they can't demonstrate more than just the token, you know, expert patient. It was about when there's going to be redesign of services, who else should be in the room as well as the clinical team is the receivers of that service. But that was always part of the programme, the reforms that were to change from where we had a manager-centred NHS and the control...
You're speaking in the past tense, which is worrying me, saying it was.
Can I just come in a bit there? It's because I think this is absolutely where maternity services have got to reach out and embrace their Jameses all over the country to say, CCGs, you've got a huge agenda. Your authorisation process is enormous and a nightmare. We can help you with one bit of it because we've got fantastic ways of engaging with local women. Might be through MSLCs. I know that there are a number of places around the country now where maybe MSLCs, as we knew them, have had their day. But as maternity services, you've got other ways of reaching out. Birth afterthought services. I know one trust that phones every single woman at 6 weeks postnatally to ask them how they thought their maternity experience went. Now, those things will be an absolute godsend to any CCG that's going through its authorisation process and thinking, we want to do far more than just tick the box on user involvement. We want to do it really. And you've got the skills and experience to do it.
So, do you want to carry on, Suzanne, and then we'll get back to questions?
I've done a presentation which we'll put up on the website and which kind of talks through the mechanics of some of the stuff around commissioning. And 6 months ago, I was asked to go into the department and develop a toolkit for the CCGs on what they needed to know about maternity services. And that, it was a fascinating process, and that's really what I wanted to focus on today. And it's kind of my big message ever since has been, I'd talk to GPs who'd say, oh God, midwives. I never see the same one from week to week. They don't share any information with me. They don't communicate. And I talk to midwives and they go, oh, GPs, they put us in a room without a computer and without a couch and we get shuffled around. And I started to feel like I was a relate counsellor. And I went to the session before lunch on the complex relationship between nurses and midwives. And I thought, actually, that could just as much stand for many of the relationships with GPs. And the conclusion of that, of Billy's piece of work on the relationship between nurses and midwives, was the need to respect each other's differences, cultures, and traditions. And we are moving into a situation where clinical commissioning groups with GPs are going to be the commissioners. And if midwives and GPs together can respect each other's traditions and cultures and behaviours and their differences, I think there is an opportunity to do things really differently. Because when I talk to people like James, they absolutely get preconception care in a way that when I've tried to talk to PCTs, we could never get that on the agenda. They absolutely get perinatal mental health, because they're the ones that see those families, those Louise Casey families and the other ones. They're the ones that get to see them. And how hard did we try through PCTs to try and get those services? So I think there is actually a huge opportunity. The other things I noticed from today were Claire Girard said, how to commission around the needs of the family, end fragmentation and put back continuity. Now, I think Claire was talking about the whole of general practice there. She didn't know how resonant those words were to maternity and to midwifery and just how significant the drive for continuity is there. But it is going to entail maternity services reaching back into general practice as much as expecting clinical commissioning groups to somehow look after maternity and make it all right for us.
Okay, time for some more questions. Second row back, third row, and then fourth row back.
We'll put it on the website for the conference.
Okay, thank you both for that. It's good to hear, and it's good to have a dialogue about commissioning so we can understand it. My speciality is infant nutrition, and this morning we've heard how, just for a very clear example, an infant feeding coordinators are being, their posts are going around the country. And we know from the evidence, and what has changed over the years, is the evidence is very strong now in certain areas of maternity care. So we know what's good to commission. And we know it's good to commission the Baby Friendly Initiative to improve infant feeding services. It's in the public health outcomes agenda. It's in the commissioning agenda for children's centres. But so what I'm saying is, how do we bridge that gap to get the commissioners then to put the right strategies in place based on the evidence to commission the right services and decommission the ones that aren't working? Because, and we've worked a lot over the last 10 years to talk to PCTs, to the government, to heads of midwifery, to commission a package that will change service. So it feels like, and now I need to talk to the GPs to do that as well, but it's very localised, which is great. But how do we get that information to the GPs? I could give you 10 commissioning points now to commission services that would improve infant feeding. How do I get that message to my local commissioning group, the Health and Wellbeing Board, the LetBiz, and get the sourcing, not reinventing the wheel that's been done by lots of fantastic people in the past?
There may be a sense of story earlier about having to kick the door down, because again I was saying it would be foolish for any clinical commissioning group, and this was not meant to be just about GPs, not to take that evidence into their programs if they're going to reform particular services, maternity services. That information is vital. How on earth can they design care without the full range of people who are providing it? And that's a message that is getting through to some CCGs. There are some that are still a bit GP-centric, and some who think they know better, and the governing body of the CCG is the reform agenda, when it isn't. That's just the way in which maybe the population health and some of the large heavy lifting arrangements can be done. The vast majority of clinical care needs to be at the dialogue where patients register for care, where the interface, where patients, I was saying earlier, describe quality at their interface, and the knowledge in the system about what is the best care pathway has got to be a collective. The whole idea of an integrated system was, and why we had the pause in the bill to just get this word of integration out, was that it cannot be delivered, and why it changed from GP commissioning, by one group of healthcare professionals. We've got to get... That's what I wanted to ask about in one feedback, because in my obstetric training, you know, we heard a lot about Ballantyne and the Ballantyne system of antenatal care, which was the shared care programme. It did allow midwives to focus on their expertise while the generalists could do interval care antenatally and postnatally. There was a shared approach as some of the practice nurses were involved as well. Is that something that would be overseen by directed by the midwife, but having a larger collective in a team approach where ladies were largely still coming into their general practice of antenatal care, but there's a range of healthcare professionals overseen by the midwife who could support the antenatal and postnatal care? There's a no for that. It's got to only be done by the midwife.
Or the competency of those practitioners are appropriate, because there's only so much a midwife can oversee. If you look at the new morning physical examination, I work with loads of GPs who just used to wiggle the hips without taking the nappy off. So, you know, it very much, yes, strong midwives tell other health professionals, perhaps that's not right, but I don't think you can put the onus on midwives, particularly in the postnatal period, to do that. I enjoyed working with my three GPs, but they very much went to play golf while I looked after the pregnant women, I have to say that. And that worked for them. But at the end of the day, those patients, I kept them informed. We worked as a team. I worry about too much expectations from midwives when there aren't enough of us still to do the job we're doing now.
No, I was talking about building capacity in an integrated clinical team for antenatal care based in a general practice. That's, you know, so taking a blood pressure and dipsticking a urine could be done by a whole range of people to support the midwife, who then does the expertise. It's ways of saying how can we work differently, rather than saying you do it all, because at the moment it seems to be completely independent, and sometimes what I used to be involved in, I'm very rarely involved now.
My name's Liz Bannon, I'm from Northern Ireland, and I listen, I suppose, with a degree of horror, because within Northern Ireland we've always had the wash through of the decisions that have made in England and the impact. And sitting at this point, watching where you're about to go and even listening to the conversation is a scary place. First and foremost, over the years, maternity services in England and consequently in Northern Ireland have been stripped of money and resources within austerity, as increasingly the roles of the midwives have become spread thin. We have gained support workers whom we've had to train, but they're not trained to be midwives. They're trained to be support workers. It is amazing that any profession will look at the role and responsibility of a different profession and make decisions. I can't imagine an anaesthetist deciding to take on some obstetrics will get you a bit of help. It wouldn't happen. With maternity services, and someone mentioned changing childbirth, there was a very clear direction for England, a clear pathway which could still now be built on to ensure that women get the services they need in an integrated continuum. And in actual fact, whilst you were saying that women don't remember who delivers them, in actual fact, the research would say women want continuity of care, not necessarily carer. And that is an important element that has to be kept. The second thing, I suppose, that came to mind when you were talking was you talked about commissioning good care. And that's fine, but I see nowhere there's a definition of what is defined as good care and how women know that they are entitled to get that level of care, because across the UK there's very different challenges that have come about. You're not starting from a level playing field. It's not utopia. There is no more money coming into the system, and one wonders how much it'll become destabilised before, again, there is another reform, which I do believe will come in another couple of years.
So with a finite resource, how do we make best use of that resource in a system that still says you register with your general practice, not to become GP-centric, but as Claire Girard was saying, 85% then of all contacts, Women who are pregnant will still see their GP in between seeing the midwife and sometimes about their maternity.
You don't try to employ another person and call them some sort of a support and cheap sort of a midwife.
I wasn't suggesting that.
That is the implication by saying, let's take the woman and divide up the tasks. Actually, it's as quick for the midwife to dip the urine, do the blood pressure, talk to the woman, do her abdominal palpation, have the whole conversation with her and build a relationship with her. That's an awful lot better than saying we can get somebody cheap, a band too, to do those bits. Women to queue up outside the blood room.
I do need getting sacked. I wasn't ever saying the current clinical team who care for that registered patient anyway, rather than the midwife doing it completely independently, because at the moment it seems though there's a complete independence of the antenatal care as described from general practice. My experience is that...
Suzanne, before we bring anyone else...
I think we're in danger of muddling maternity care with midwifery care. They are not the same thing. The maternity team is a much wider team, and I do think this thing about respecting other people's contributions and traditions and behaviours and what they bring is absolutely where modern midwifery has got to be. It's that modern midwifery has got to choose where it can make the most impact, where it can make the biggest difference, and where other people, they might be general practitioners. And why is it that women who have urinary tract infections in hospitals half the time end up in your triage on your labour ward because they can't get a hold of a community midwife? It's because the relationship with general practice is broken down and those women don't go to their GP. Now, that would absolutely work for James. It would absolutely work for midwives. And yet, when we've done work on unscheduled antenatal care, a lot of routine conditions of pregnancy that occur in pregnancy are ending up in the acute sector. And that's, to me, about what people have got far too territorial instead of wanting to work as a team. And if there is any good that can come of these reforms, and like Claire, I'm probably a very old socialist, but if there's any good that can come of these reforms, it will be about asking people to work together and to try and put aside some of those territorial disputes and say, we're all stuffed with not enough money, we're all stuffed with not enough time, and therefore we're going to have to work the best we can together in order to give a good deal for women.
We can say that antenatal care is the perfect example of preventative medicine. It's probably the longest example of preventative medicine in the pee and quit, which we're not doing very well. But that preventative medicine as a process can't be just delivered by one healthcare professional. There's the expertise, and I'm not saying taking away from the expertise or somebody else dabbling with it, but the whole process of preventative medicine, whether it's stopping smoking and getting best health preconceptually and supporting the midwifery process with a bigger team within general practice, is what I'm talking about. Is that something that we could develop?
Colleagues, we're going to have to wind up in a minute, but I'll take two more questions. There's a lady at the back with her hand up for a long time. Just behind you. Yeah, there.
Thank you. It's just a comment, really, from previously. My name's Sandra Smith. I work as the Northwest Regional Antenatal Screening Coordinator, and one of our practices is one-to-one midwifery. And it's just to say that with any qualified provider rule, they're treated exactly the same as any other provider. Part of our role now is quality assurance, and we collect data on how well or not, or what challenges they're facing, through the screening programmes. And they comply, they treat any request for data with respect. We get information back from them. So as long as they're exactly the same, I can't see there being a problem with them. It'd be interesting to know how they work in a bigger team with the GPs. Perhaps you can tell us about that.
On a personal basis, I know of them. I've had no experience. None of my or any patients registered with our practice have been to their programme. But they are getting, it's anecdotal, but those patients who have been through the one-to-one system in or their care in Wirral has got very good feedback at the moment.
Okay, one more question at the back there.
Hi, thank you. Maria Dorr, Head of Midwifery from Southampton. It strikes me that we're all a little bit defensive about this, and actually if we're going to really, truly reform and work together, we've got to think about the way we work in partnership, and the key is in the pathway. You know, women get pregnant, they will choose to see their GP, they will choose to access their midwife, they may choose to have a maternity support worker working alongside them to support them in the postnatal period, they will want to come and have their midwife for birth. But actually, we just need to understand our roles and responsibilities along that pathway. They will leave midwifery care and they will be picked up by their health visitor, by other professionals and other workers in the community. And we just have to get to grips with that. It isn't any good thinking we're going backwards. There is no money in the economy. We have to work together. And the defensiveness that we are all sharing and keep going back and repeating is not going to see us in the future. I'm really sorry. So let's work in partnership and think about what the women will want along their pathway and where their next steps might be.
And on that positive note, we're going to have to finish, I'm afraid. But before we go, can we thank both James and Suzanne for a really interesting debate?
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.